Pity Heart Moxon, Reel 5.
This particular interrogation, that I was actually transferred. And of course, when my number was called, I thought they realized that this also I was implicated, because we were all to some extent implicated, because we managed to sabotage and take some of these jewelry and hand it over to the resistance, because they didn't know, but they suspected that we were implicated, which many of us were. And when my number was called, I thought some evidence had been found, but in fact my number was called and I was told I was to be transferred back to Birkenau to be put on transport with my mother. Of course, what I didn't know was an event that happened while I was in Canada, which enabled me to be transferred.
Can you tell us about how your mother was in Africa?
Well, what I didn't realize that my mother had managed to buy my number and her number to be included on a list of privileged prisoners who were to be transported to work in some factory, because we didn't know if anyone was transported anywhere, but if there was such an occasion where people were being evacuated from Auschwitz, then of course one had to take the chance. Very often it was a case of, yes, you were going to be evacuated, and then the train went back to the crematoria. But because this was a list of semi, I would say, privileged prisoners, also there were some block leaders, and there were also some capos, and there was also Henia, my friend, who was a messenger girl. So my mother figured out that because they were all privileged prisoners, possibly this was a transport that would be evacuated somewhere to some factory. Now, I didn't know all this, but of course what enabled her to do this was what I brought back into the camp, so she had to, because she had to pay for this. Nobody did anything for you unless you actually paid for, just the same as it is today. And one day she didn't quite realize how I was going to be able to join her, because there was talk of the liquidation of the Canada Commando, and liquidation meant only one thing, that everybody was going to be killed. And she waited for days to speak to one of the commandants, and his name was Hessler, Franz Hessler. And she knew him, well, she didn't ever spoken to him, but she knew of him, and he wasn't quite as bad as some of the other commandants, and he'd often come, and she'd seen him, how he behaved towards prisoners, also when he came to her, into her hut, when he came into the hospital. So one day she took a chance and hid behind a block, and when she saw him standing there with the Lagerälteste Orly, that was the chief prisoner, she decided to approach, which was very much unheard of in the Auschwitz hierarchy. An ordinary prisoner could never come and speak to the commandant. But my mother just cleaned herself up as well as she could, and she went up to this commandant and said, "I beg the commandant, number 39933 begs to speak to the commandant." This is how you had to address the commandant, and you were never allowed to actually look them in the face, so she had to look down. And he said, "Yes, what is it?" And he explained that she'd been in the camp almost 2 years, working in the hospital, and that I was working in Canada, and I've been there 8 months, and that now we are to go, she will be going on transport, and I have been included in this transport, and would it be possible for him to release me from Canada and have me transferred? But he didn't give her an answer. But the next thing that happened, my number was called out. He just asked for my number, and that was all that was needed. My number was called out at roll call in the midst of the interrogation for the uprising, and I was called out, and the next thing was I was transferred and went on evacuation with my mother.
Before we go any further on, could you tell me about your friend
Ginger's suicide? I can tell you very little.
Sorry.
Oh, she's very little. She, yeah, she saw her father and
So Kitty, could you now move in time, and describe to us the death march on foot from the slave labor factory as far as Trautenhaus.
We now are at the the point of the 18th of February 1945, which happened to have been my mother's birthday. We were all lined up, and we were told we have what is known as a Marschbefehl, which means an order to evacuate. We had no idea where the front was, but of course it was extremely close, because we heard gunfire and we thought we might be liberated any moment. But at that point, we were told we were going on foot, and we didn't know where we were going. My mother said, oh, this is a marvelous birthday present, I'm actually going to have a walk, which she didn't realize, that she was going to be on a death march. We walked out at dawn, and we were joined possibly by a long column of about 10,000 women from all the neighboring small factories and slave labor camps. We were taken not along a main road, which was choked with military convoys. Germans retreating. We saw them actually retreat. We couldn't go on secondary roads because the German population was fleeing. So we realized that the Russians must have been very close, but the Germans are fleeing as well. So we were taken along side paths through small villages and mostly through open country. Of course, soon people started to lag behind, and we knew it was imperative that we, all our 100 Auschwitz, we were 100 Auschwitz girls, had to stick together. We realized that soon we would need help from one another. We couldn't carry our belongings. Most of us were by that time already barefoot, and we wrapped our feet in rags. We had to throw quite a lot of clothes because we couldn't carry anything. We were guarded by some elderly, well, which we thought were elderly, perhaps men in about their 40s, soldiers, who were not inclined to carry their own kit and passed it down the column. And of course we didn't want to carry their kit either, so we used to pass it down, and no one wanted to be last, to be left with a kit. So it was imperative to stick to the front. We were not issued with any food whatsoever, so it was a matter of either you try and get some food at best you could, or you starve and you fall by the wayside. Of course, if anyone had lagged behind was either clubbed to death or shot. So you didn't want to lag behind. At night, there were some nights we slept in barns and found milking cows, or found eggs in chicken huts, or even raided farms. The population didn't seem to be there. Sometimes we saw carts being wheeled with potatoes and beet, and if that happened, we would throw ourselves on the cart and try and take whatever we could. People who didn't do that simply died of starvation. There was nothing to drink, but of course it was a harsh winter and there was snow, and we were simply eating snow at that point. There wasn't any other fluid. One night we stayed in a coal mine, and when we emerged, we were totally black. Some nights were spent simply on the roadside. What we did do is we tried to keep watch on the guards. So when they were asleep, we would stray and forage for food. Very often in barns we would find cabbages or anything remotely edible we would eat. One day, I can't remember how many days we were on this march, by the way. It seemed endless. It might have been a week, 2 weeks, I don't know. One day there was a commotion, and a cart with potatoes went by, and I threw myself on this cart, and of course next thing I knew I was hit by a rifle butt from behind, and I believe I was knocked out. And after that, I believe I was carried by my friends until I regained consciousness. But I carried on nonetheless. It transpired I did have a fractured skull. Eventually, I was told that's what had happened. But nevertheless, I continued my death march the following day. We marched through the woods towards a mountain range called the Eulengebirge, and the only pathway that was open to us was a very narrow pass over the top of the summit and down the other side. So we actually had to climb to the top, which is quite high. I think it might have been something like 1,000 meters. It was pretty high. When we got to the top, there was a most amazing sight. It was a plateau, in fact. It was a flat area. And there were hundreds of Germans in their carts, still asleep because it was early morning, with sort of they had hoods over their carts, and they had sausages and all kind of things hanging hanging all over the carts. And there were a lot of cows. And I remember I threw myself onto one of the cows and started milking. Unfortunately, I threw myself at the biggest cow, which turned out a bull. And I was thrown to the side, and of course my mother grabbed me and told me, this is a bull. And the next thing was we started raiding the German population, because they didn't know what had hit them. About 10,000 women suddenly overrun this area, and the soldiers couldn't shoot because of the civilians that were around. So we managed to grab quite a lot of food. And at one point, I dislodged a whole bucket, and I didn't know what was inside, but it was hanging from one of the carts. And when I looked at it, it was just a bucket of lard. And I thought, well, what am I going to do with this? And my mother was absolutely overjoyed, because she said, oh, that's wonderful, because many of us already had frostbite on our toes and on our hands. Many of the girls were barefoot. And so we actually smeared ourselves in this. We passed it down the column, and everybody smeared themselves with this lard, the hands and the face and the hair, and it protected us from the cold. So in fact, it was very valuable. And we went over this pass, over to the other side when we were actually gathered together, eventually we came to a camp where we were allowed to stay for 2 days before they shipped us in open carriages to the next camp.
On that march, Kitty, in spite of the absolutely appalling conditions, did you begin to experience any hope of freedom?
Well, during this death march, various thoughts came into our heads, obviously. We realized that there was this open territory, and if the guards are asleep, maybe some of us should take a chance and escape. But then we were talking about this, and we're thinking, well, should we, shall we not? Some girls took a chance, but we did hear shots fired in distant places, and we realized that probably many of the girls that managed to escape either had been recaptured or had been denounced. And of course we were on German soil, and we realized no one was going to harbor us, because they were would have been in danger themselves. So we realized that our chances of survival outside the column were probably even slimmer than staying together. Although we did realize that liberation cannot be very far, but because the front wasn't far, but of course we realized also that they were not going to let us free. They were not going to allow us to fall into the hands of the Allies. So some people became quite depressed, because we were at point of liberation already in the last camp, and here we were being shipped right across Germany on the point of liberation again.
Maybe we can move forward again. I want you to talk about your liberation from Salzwedel. So if you need to have a little think about how to get into that story, go ahead.
We were transported from one camp to another. At one stage, we worked 12 shifts underground in a factory that was subterranean. It was part of the Philips factory, in fact, and we were shipped there on the specific orders of Speer, who believed that we had some special skills, which of course we didn't, but it was on his orders that we were actually shipped to a place called Porta Westfalica and worked underground, but no work was no longer in progress, because they could no longer get parts to the aircraft, parts that they needed. So in fact no work was carried out, but nonetheless we did 12-hour shifts, 11 shifts, I believe, 11 shifts underground. Eventually we sometime in the beginning of the middle of March, there was again what was known as a Marschbefehl, and we realized that the Allies must be very close, because we were now evacuated to the east, whereas previously we landed up almost at the Dutch frontier. and now we were evacuated eastwards. At that point, a very unfortunate thing happened, and we lost almost half of our original Auschwitz group that survived many years in Auschwitz, and almost 6 months post-Auschwitz, which was a very, very difficult period because food was very scarce. There wasn't the accommodation was scarce. We were shunted from one place to another, and a lot of people died. And at that point, we lost a lot of our girls. And at point of liberation, there were only 12 of us, or 12 or 14 of us, of the group of 100. We were eventually liberated in a place called Salzwedel. But the circumstances of liberation were also very extraordinary, because we were placed, which was probably the worst experience of the whole of the war. We were locked in an airtight truck, which to us smelled of cheese. And many of the girls began to faint. And really, I believe the only way my mother and I survived is because I had a knife and I enlarged a crack on the floor of the truck. And my mother and I took it in turns to breathe. Now, we'd been locked in and bolted, in fact, in that truck somewhere on a siding outside Belsen for some time. And muffled sounds could be heard at first from the trucks next to us, but eventually there were no sounds at all, and we realized that all these people were by now dead. And suddenly we heard some footsteps, and with all our might we began to scream and bang against the doors of this truck, and suddenly they opened this one truck. And when the truck was opened, we simply fell out of the truck, and we fell out on two, or was it three, I can't remember, men, that's all, two or three men. And one was an officer, and then I think they were surprised at what they'd done. They opened this truck. And my mother said, "You can kill us here now, but we're not going back into this truck. We demand, in fact, to be taken into a camp." And these men conferred, and one of them went off on a bicycle, and he came back and said, "The commandant of a camp nearby agreed to take you in." And this is how I came to a place called Salzwedel, where we were liberated on the 14th of April,
1945. Could you describe that liberation?
A few days prior to liberation, there was no food at all anymore in this camp. They had thrown in the guards had, or the women actually, the women guards had thrown in a heap of rotten cabbages into one corner of the camp, and no other food was distributed. Bullets began to fly all over, and we had to take cover. So we realized that the front is extremely close. The next thing that happened, I think it probably was the night prior to liberation, white little bits of paper started fluttering down from nowhere. And these were messages from French prisoners of war who had already been liberated to tell us that the whole camp has been mined and they were planning to blow it up. The order was, in fact, to blow the camp up, and that they were going to cut the wires to enable us to escape. Some 24 hours prior to liberation, by that time most of us were almost, I would say, at the point of death, because we hadn't had any food for probably not proper food or proper rations for about 2 or 3 weeks by that time, and certainly not the time we'd been locked in this truck, and nothing by the time we came into Salzwedel. And I was simply sitting, could no longer walk properly, at the fence, and across my electrified fence I could see a whole area of shelves with loaves, just bread. In fact, it was known as the broodkamer. That means the room where they were kept keeping bread, possibly for distribution in the camp, which they never did. And that also, there were no more SS personnel. Not a single uniform could be seen. But of course, the fences were electrified, and no one dared to touch the fences. That was prior to liberation. I was just sitting there when someone actually shook me by the shoulder and said, "Look, there's some tanks." And I said, "Yes, what tanks?" And she said, "Well, these don't look like German tanks. They've got like a star on them." And yes, they were certainly not German tanks. And we realized some army, we didn't know what army it was. We thought perhaps it was a Russian army. But it wasn't. It was American tanks that had actually rolled past and didn't even bother to come into the camp. They just rolled past us. It was only after screaming and shouting and a lot of noise that one tank actually turned around and bulldozed into the camp. And that was the point of liberation. At that point, we knew we were liberated by the Americans.
And how did this three-day rampage start?
Well, the very first things the Americans said to us, "Oh, you're all free, but remember, we've got no food for you, but go into town, there's a town very close, go and get it." And so, of course, the gates were open. I don't know whether they just smashed the gates open, I can't remember, and everyone who was still able to run or walk just poured out of the camp. And of course we didn't know how far we were from the town, because we came from a siding somewhere, but it wasn't very far, and everybody poured into this little town of Salzwedel, and the first thing we did was simply rushed around to see if we could find any food. Unfortunately, we, the liberated prisoners, were a little bit too late, because there were a lot of forced laborers all around the region, including prisoners of war, and they had been liberated days before, and they had already plundered and rampaged through the town. So by the time we came to plunder, there was very little left. But nonetheless, I recall, for instance, going into a dairy. And we came into this dairy and we overturned all the churns that were full of milk, great big churns, and we splashed in this milk and drank it with our hands and sort of bathed in the milk. And then we rushed into the houses, obviously to try and look for some food, but also just to see what it was like inside a house, which we hadn't seen for so long. We looked for sugar, bread, anything edible. There was very little at that stage. And of course, we didn't see any people. They had all disappeared. They were all in the area shelters, hiding away. And of course, I very nearly killed at that point. But fortunately, I didn't, which to my great relief, I didn't do.
How did you come to nearly kill?
Well, we walked from we rushed from one house into another, and tried to lie in the beds, and we even set fire to some of the places. We opened up taps all we wanted to do actually was just to destroy. We didn't want to take anything except food. We were all in rags, we were barefoot, but we didn't really take any clothes or anything to wear. We were simply not interested. All we really were looking for was something to eat. We loosened a bathtub in one house, and we filled it with all kind of provisions, and we carted that back to the camp. Well, in one house, we got into one house, and we could hear some voices, which came from down below. And so there was quite a lot of people in that house, could have been 20, 30, that we all rushed into this house. And we heard these voices, and somebody said, "Oh, we must go down to all these people there. We've got to do something to these people down there." So we rushed down into this room, and it was in semi-darkness. And I could just make out there was some elderly people there, some women, there were some children there, and a child started to cry. And the crowd behind me, I had a knife. I always believed that you were not allowed to have a knife. That was against all rules and regulations. But I always believed you had to have a knife, because one day it might save your life. And certainly there were occasions when this did happen. So I had a bayonet. In fact, I had a bayonet because I took this particular bayonet from one SS man who ventured back into the camp about 2 or 3 days prior to liberation, and he was unarmed except for his dagger, and I got this dagger off him. And we rushed into this house, and everybody behind me was screaming, kill the first person, and I just took this dagger and I threw it in the opposite direction to the people, because I realized at that point I was very near to killing. And it suddenly came to me that There were these people huddled in the corner. They were afraid, just as I was afraid a few days previously, hiding in the corner. I couldn't possibly kill. There was a child there as well. And the child was just as innocent as I might have been when I was a child. So I threw this dagger, and I threw myself on the floor crying. And soon after that, people came up to me and shook my hands. Those were these Germans hiding in the corner. And they just shook me by the hand and thanked me for throwing this knife. And we all rushed out. Everybody just sort of retreated and rushed out of the cellar. And that's very vivid in my mind. We rampaged through the town for 3 days. My mother was not fit enough to come out, and she wouldn't anyway. She said, no, that's not what she's going to do. She was busy reporting on... In fact, her report was one of the first that went out to the world about conditions in Auschwitz, because she spoke English very well. And she was interviewed by the reporters from the American Armed Forces. And she was busy just reporting all day long on what actually had happened. But when I came back, she said, now you've been there 3 days. Well, what about a pair of shoes at least? We could do with some shoes, or we could do with something to wear. So I went back into the town searching for a pair of shoes. And I got into a shoe shop, and boxes and boxes of what I thought were shoes, but it was all empty. There was just nothing in the boxes. All I could find was two left men's shoes. And I brought these two left men's shoes back to the camp, and my mother said, oh dear, what am I going to do with two left shoes? But sooner or later, we converted one left shoe into a right shoe, and so one of us had a pair of shoes. That was our rampage through Salzwedel.
Yeah, all right. Right, we needed this. Could you tell us, you had a particularly strong will to survive, Kitty. What was one of the main motivations behind that?
Well, I think one of the main motivations was that I saw so much that I felt I had to survive to tell the truth, because if everybody died, then we would never know what had happened. And history might be rewritten by people who think they knew. So I felt I had to survive to tell the truth. That was probably my main concern. My other concern was that I wanted to live. I didn't have much of a life beforehand, or what life I had was very good, and I really wanted to go on living. I was always full of life, and this is what motivated me, and nothing was going to stand in the way. I didn't feel depressed about my situation. I saw it as one way or another I had to come through this. It wasn't a question of hatred. I realized pretty soon that revenge is not going to bring me happiness, and that hatred is just self-destructive. That came to me at the point where I was going to kill. I realized that this means hatred if you kill somebody. That's not what I want. I felt what we need is more tolerance. That came to me quite quickly. But it also came to me quickly that I have to record what happened to me immediately before it fades from my memory. And I started working on this already in the DP camp in 1946 to record. So that both my mother and I could relate to one another and as accurately as possible record all the events and bear witness to record history.
Well, you did survive, Kitty, and you were able to tell people what had happened. But do you think that this has been a terrible burden on your life? How has it really sort of shaped your outlook since then?
Well, I think my past totally shaped my outlook on life. It totally dominated my life from the point of liberation. I call it was my university, because that's where I learned everything about life, about human nature, about relationships, about how to treat people, how not to treat people. It was a complete education, which you'd never get anywhere else.
And I believe it was very difficult for you to have relationships with people afterwards as a result of your experiences. Is that true?
No, I didn't find that. No, I found I didn't have difficulties with relationships. I valued all the relationships very much so, because I saw what friends can do for one another. What saddened me so much is that you don't get the type of friendships that you had in those days, that you don't get the sacrifices that you get that you had then, and that people will simply not sacrifice anything to the same extent as they did in Auschwitz. So in that respect, it was disappointing. I had much higher hopes. I also had higher hopes for a better world, which of course didn't happen. I had hopes for a non-violent world.
Do you feel depressed sometimes when you see what is happening in the news today? Do you feel that no lessons have been learned?
I think I'm absolutely positive that no lessons, or very few lessons, have been learned from the past. Because if lessons had been learned, you wouldn't today have as many extremists or dictators who had gained power. If people had learned lessons, they wouldn't allow this. And maybe a testimony like mine, the importance of it is to serve as a warning to future generations. Because the danger is that whether you're black or whether you're white, whether you're Christian, whether you're Muslim or whether you're Jew, what happened to me could in future happen to you. So I think the lessons have not been learned. And this is one of the most important aspects of the testimony, a warning to the future generations.